individual who was responsible for Englander's violation, but who had been literally an aluminum siding salesman on Long Island before that. Milton Gould. Did you know Milton?
I know of him.
You know him by reputation?
Yeah.
Milton Gould represented Tager. Milton Gould and I later became fast friends, but that was virtually our first encounter. And it was an argument in a broker-dealer case before the full five-member commission, believe it or not. Broker-dealer revocation. I think there had been separate proceedings before the hearing examiner. They were consolidated. I don't remember exactly. My guy was a poor schnook, essentially, who didn't know anything about the business. He'd been in it 6 months. Didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what was permitted and what was not permitted. And yeah, he shouldn't have been in the business, but, you know, an admonition would have been appropriate and a suspension for some period of time, maybe, and you know, make him take a few NASD courses, but that's... Tager was a bad boy. Milton said to me, as we got into the commission hearing room, he says, "Kid," I was probably 10, 15 years younger, but, "Hey, kid, do you mind if I go first?" "No." So Milton goes first, and Milton talks about how, you know, they didn't know what they were doing, they had nothing to do with it, I mean, you know, they weren't trained, there was no this, there was no that, and he goes on and on and on and on. But he's not talking about Tager. Tager knew what he was doing. Tager had been in the business for a long time. Tager had run a boiler room for some time before that. My guy was the, you know, and he goes on. And so finally, he finishes. And I got up, and I said, "May it please the commission, I will not take up your time, because you see, to follow the eloquence of Mr. Gould would ordinarily be difficult, but in this case it's very easy, because he wasn't talking about his client. He was talking about my client." And I sat down. He turned to me and said, "You're all right, kid." From then on, we had one case I had with him much later on. You know, it was just a riot, right? You know, well, the Vesco case. He came in on there was an application to appoint a receiver for IOC. And he gets before the judge and he says, "Judge, you don't need a receiver. I'm here now. I'm representing the company. You know me, nothing could go wrong. I'll make certain that nothing goes wrong." And the judge bought it. Or I had another case with Milton Gould where we finished it. And it was another case where, similar to Tager, where I tried to distinguish between the two clients, and he gets up after me and he says, "Hey, kid, you've left me nothing to do but to piss all over you." I'll edit that out.
Why?
But he was, you know, but Milton Gould's another guy. He could have told Stanley, you know, anything he wanted, and Stanley would believe him, and rightfully so. And he was part of the group that understood what the function of the commission was, what the function of the staff was. On the other hand, Stanley, because of the fact that everybody knew Stanley pretty well, there was a guy named lawyer Harvey.
I'm trying to think of it.
Who said to me, "You're going to help me out. I've got this case, et cetera, et cetera." The assistant director won't listen to me because he says Stanley will never approve the proposed settlement, and I can't get Sporkin to see me. can you get me a plywood's board? That didn't seem like an outrageous request. I called Stanley. I said, Stanley, see this guy for me. Oh, no, he's a bummy, no good. Stanley, favor to me, please. See the guy, listen to him. You know, another one of these. You're starting to get, you know, too cuff-like. Listen to the guy. He's got a story to tell. He's entitled to be heard. Okay, the guy went down to Washington. Finished, he called me up. He said, thanks for the appointment. I said, how'd it go? He said, I walked in. Sporkin was sitting on the corner of his desk. I walked in there, and I forget the guy's name. And he said, I didn't even get a chance to say hello. And Sporkin says, I've had enough of your shit in this case.
What do you think Landis would have said about the way Stanley operated the Division of Enforcement? They had very different personalities.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They would not have understood each other at all. At all. No. I shouldn't say that. On an intellectual level, they certainly would have. I mean, in terms of a philosophical level, if they were talking about the philosophy of enforcement, or the concepts of due process, or things like that sort of, absolutely. But in terms of the day-to-day, mm-hmm. what do you do with the mm-hmm. with the broker dealer, aluminum siding salesman, and how heavy a sanction? That they would not have been able to talk to each other about. But Landis was a great person.
I'm just curious, in writing a report like that, I always figure that the most interesting things are the things that get edited out at the very end. Do you remember, were there ideas or subjects or things that you considered recommending and then for one reason or another decided not to?
Not that I can recall. Except I don't think that the report talked about an independent corps of hearing examiners. That was.
I don't remember it.
I don't think so.
No, it talks about an independent adjudicatory. It considers a proposal where the commissioners would be entirely responsible for adjudication,
mm-hmm.
And that the rulemaking and policy functions would be delegated to a department. And Landis was very much, it sounds like from the report, very much against that idea.
Right. No, he come from the other point of view, that the commission was there to make policy and not to adjudicate broker-dealer cases or stop order proceedings.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting in that report, and it's hinted at, and there are several places where he talks about the political influence that commissioners of the various regulatory agencies have been subjected to.
He's talking about Matt Conley in the White House and his experience at the CAB.
And what was that? Oh, okay.
I told you about it, yeah. When they changed, when they eradicated the signature.
Right. And is that what he's referring to?
I think so.
I was curious whether there were incidents that he knew of during the 50s, during the Eisenhower administration, that...
Well, he came around to representing one trip. He came around to representing... But, you know, he did some crazy things. You know, he ran for president of the Airline Pilots Association. So, it was ridiculous.
And he almost won.
And he almost won. Until he got up and made a speech. Where do you get all this from?
I read the biography.
Oh.
It's
until he got up and made a speech, which he had been proposed by the Eastern Airlines pilots. He had represented them in a merger with the Colonial Airlines or something. And so he was very close to Eastern Airlines pilots. They came to him. There was a hotly contested union election. They wanted him to run for president of the union. And he did. And he almost won until he went to a a meeting just before the vote. He was asked, well, what specifically would be your program? Is that in the book? And he said, I shall be guided by the stars I cannot see. This is a quote from something. Now, for a pilot to be told he's going to be guided by the stars, where'd they get this madman?
Yeah, that brings up the question that, you know, how does Jim Melendez fail to pay income taxes for 4 years? Did he ever talk to you about this?
Oh, yes. I mean, the book says he was represented by Bill Warren, but I was instrumental in that. You ever read the Novosky book on Kennedy justice?
My father has it on his shelf.
Read it. That has the full story of the tax thing and what happened. And to tell it to you a little more briefly, during the time we're practicing law, we were doing pretty well. And I was reasonably close to his secretary, who kept saying to me from time to time, Mr. Feldman, you ought to talk to Mr. Landis. An awful lot of money in his checking account. It shouldn't be just sitting in the checking account. And I'd say, Jim, you know, I understand that a lot of money in the checking account. I should be doing something. Well, no, I'm doing something. I have to do something. And then one day, while he's working in the White House, I get this call from Joe Kennedy, Ambassador Kennedy. And he says, Justin, who does your tax returns? I said, well, the firm's tax returns, the partnership return, is done by an accountant. As a matter of fact, was recommended to us by your accountant. But individually, we do our own returns. He said, is it possible that Jim hasn't filed a return in 4 or 5 years? I said, I don't know. I know I see him go home with stuff around April every year, and I assume, he doesn't look for my return, I don't look at his. He said, is he there? I said, no, he's making a speech in Pittsburgh today, I understand. Well, it turned out that in the course of the investigation with respect to his position at the White House, the New York director of the IRS couldn't find his tax returns. Went to Kennedy's account and told him that, but said that he could hold up reporting it to the FBI, but he would like to be the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Well, he did not become the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, and it turned out that in 1958, Jim got an extension, as we all do from time to time, and he got an extension to October 15th on his 57 return. And he was up in Boston writing speeches for Jack, and he had not filed a return despite the extension, because in his meticulous Calvinistic way, he had inherited some money from his mother, about $3,500 in stock that he had sold because his daughter and his son-in-law had contracted polio and they needed money, and he didn't know the basis. Rather than show a zero basis, which would have meant, $1,100 tax, $100 tax at that time, he put it aside and pursued the lawyer for his mother's estate and found out that he didn't know the basis either, because his mother had inherited it from his father. And at that time, he started doing a tax return for the following year, and there was a question if he filed prior year returns on time, and he couldn't say no. He couldn't say yes, and he didn't want to say no. So he put it aside until it was fine. He procrastinated for 5 years worth. And that's what he meant when he said to me he would never sit down for a confirmation hearing. And that's what he meant when he said he had that money in the checking account, because he had to do something with it. He never would even put it in a savings account to earn interest on it, because it wasn't his money. And then Joe Kennedy told him to go see Bobby to get the accountant in, prepare the returns, and get them filed in a hurry. And we worked around the clock for days to create 4 or 5 years of returns. And he didn't have enough cash. And Joe gave him the money he needed to file those returns. And he went to see Bobby. And Bobby told him to go see Mort Kaplan. Mort Kaplan was the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. And the rule then was, if you file voluntarily, that they would forgive the failure to file. But if you were filing under compulsion, they'd have to evaluate it. In the meanwhile, right after he had filed, unbeknownst to me, he's called down to Internal Revenue to be asked about why he filed late. He explains all that. And then, why did he file when he filed? And he says, my friend, Ambassador Kennedy, found out about it and called it to my attention, and I filed. Mort Kaplan, when he reviews it, says, I don't know, I mean, it's very unusual, whether I don't know whether he filed under compulsion or he filed voluntarily, when he filed in response to the urging of the father of the President of the United States. And so he referred it. He said, called Bobby and said, I have to send it to the Justice Department for a determination. Bobby was fit to be tied. I mean, that was an unnecessary call. It was not that he'd filed because, you know, there was a problem. Of course, Kaplan, who now knows why. So refers it to the Justice Department, and it goes to Oberdorf. Lou Oberdorf, our federal judge.
He's still sitting on the bench?
I think so. Is he?
He is. Yeah.
And Lou Oberdorfer was the Assistant Attorney General and started in charge of the Tax Division. When Lou Oberdorfer was nominated for that position, he had a problem of a conflict of interest that he did not know how to handle before the Senate committee. And Bobby asked Landis to consult with him and to represent him, or to consult with him in connection with his testimony on confirmation. and Landis did. And Oberdorfer asked him if he owed him a fee, and Landis said, no, forget about it. So Oberdorfer disqualified himself on the grounds that he had a potential conflict of interest. I'm very surprised Oberdorfer ever got to be a fucking judge. It was probably under Johnson rather than probably after Bobby was out of the Attorney General's office. So it went to Katzenbach. And there is the story of, you know, meanwhile I had retained Bill Warren as the dean of the Columbia Law School to represent him because I didn't want to do it myself. I was calling the shots, and we got him to a psychiatrist, and we had a psychiatrist work up on self-destruction and all kinds of things. And Katzenbach came to see me and said that they were going to have to refer it to Morgendorf, the United States Attorney. And they're going to try to do it under circumstances where, you know, it could be handled and so forth. And I said, no way, you can't do that. I mean, he said, what are we going to do? How are we going to get rid of it? The president's going to be running for re-election. I said, put him before a grand jury. Put the psychiatrist's testimony before a grand jury. I'll go before the grand jury. A lot of people know what stress he was under at the time. Put him before a grand jury. And Nick Katzenbach says to me, Justin, you're going to take the man who recommended to the President of the United States that he reorganize 7 regulatory agencies on the basis of whose recommendation the President has reorganized 6 regulatory agencies. And you're going to tell a grand jury he was crazy? Jim will never do it. I know Jim better than you do. I said, well, I'm going to tell Jim to do it. Because if the President of the United States, and I remember saying this to Jim in tears, and if the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States, after all he has meant and done for the Kennedy family, under circumstances where it's because of what he did for the Kennedy family, he didn't file his return on time initially, want to refer this for a criminal prosecution, I'm prepared to put him into the grand jury and say that he was under a psychiatric disability. He said to me, don't play God. Where's Jim? I want Jim to make that call in front of my face. I said, okay. Walked him into Jim's office across the hall. I told him the story. Jim looked at me and he said, Justin, as well as you know me, Nick is right. Nobody's going to say that any of those agencies were reorganized by a man who had a psychiatric difficulty and didn't know what he was doing. So what do we do, Nick? You say you can be handled. Well, he says, we'll talk to Morgan. We'll pick a judge who's our judge. And we'll do it on a weekend. We'll do it on a Labor Day weekend when there's no a lot of publicity. And we'll get Morgendorf, you know, filing information, and we'll dispose of it. So they do that. And they bring it on before the Honorable Wilford Feinberg, young district judge, young, ambitious then district judge, later to go on become the chief judge of the Second Circuit, who says to Morgan, who, without saying anything to anybody, goes to see the chief judge, Sylvester Ryan, and tells him what's happening, and says, I don't know what to do. I owe my appointment to Kennedy. He's Justin Feldman's partner, and Justin Feldman was my college classmate and fraternity brother and my law school classmate. And my poker buddy, we used to play in the same poker game. And Ryan says, you're a young judge, you don't need this. I'll take your calendar. And I get a call from Morgenthau saying, the thing's gotten screwed up, Feinberg's recused himself, Sylvester Ryan's got the calendar. And he's giving Jim a lecture about how he knows about drinking, and he comes from an old Irish family, they drink too much. No, thank you very much, Harriet. And he sentenced him to 30 days in jail to dry out. I went bananas. I said to Morgenthau, what can we do? He said, well, the Attorney General can have him sent to a hospital so he doesn't have to go to a jail. Meanwhile, they take him to the jail in Staten Island. And I call the Attorney General, and he's off Labor Day weekend, he's off fishing off the coast of Labrador. I call the White House. Evelyn Lincoln says, I said, I got to talk to the president. She said, what's up? I tell her. She says, stay where you are. She's back on the line, and she said, the Attorney General will call you from the vessel he's on. In the next 5 minutes. And he called and said, what can I do? And I said, you can directly go to a hospital. He said, tell Morgenthau I so direct. They sent him to the Public Health Service Hospital on Staten Island, where that night they took his belt away, they took his shoelaces away. Wife called me the next day. Finally, on Tuesday, the day after Labor Day, I went down to Washington. I went to see Nick, and I said, I want to transfer to private hospital, New York Presbyterian. You can put guards on the door, we'll pay for the guards. Oh, we can't do that. I said, why me? Oh, you know, we can't show favoritism now. I'm going to see the AG. He said, you go see anybody you want. I went upstairs and saw Bobby and told him the story. He said, do I have the power to direct what hospital he goes to? I said, I think you do. He gets Nick on the speakerphone. He says, Nick, Justin's in my office. He says, I have the power to direct what hospital Jim goes to. Is that right? He says, you do, but he's a public service hospital. Isn't that enough? He said, no, it's not enough. I want him to go to whatever hospital Justin wants him to go to. He said, well, do you imagine the publicity? He said, Nick, this is the best friend the Kennedy family ever had. Don't talk to me. So that's my Landis story.
Extraordinary. Hey, if you don't mind me asking, when he came out the last couple of years...
He came out. It wasn't the last couple of years. The first thing that happened is that they tried to disbar him. Mm-hmm. We had a disbarment proceeding. And he was suspended from the bar for a year. And the week after that happened is when he was found dead in a swimming pool. And it was just... As you can tell, I love the man dearly. He was an unusual mind. I mean, was he self-destructive? Was he? Did he drink too much? Did he? He'd grown up as the son of missionaries in Japan. He came to the States at 14 or 15 years of age without parents to go to school. parents to go to college in Princeton or whatever. Remarkable mind. He's a good human being. He's destroyed himself.
Question I had is, I think very few commission staff today know and appreciate the how significant James Landis was to the development of the securities laws and to the formation and implementation of the commission.
They do or they don't?
They don't have a good appreciation for it. And it also seemed to me that Landis, any one of his careers, whether it was the chairman of the SEC or the dean of the Harvard Law School or the chair of the Civil Aeronautics Board or all the other positions that he held, any one of those careers would be enough.
At least ambassador in the Middle East.
Would have been enough for any one person in a career. Do you have a view of Landis's significance as a man and as a person in the commission's history, where he fits today relative to all the different commissions and chairmen and commissioners that we've had? I mean, is he still ranked up there as the very top, or I mean, can you give us some color on?
I have not known all of the commissioners that well. I mean, I knew Carey, I knew Casey, I knew Weep. I knew Manny. None of them, I don't know Kennedy, none of them had the intellectual, conceptual scope. I know Arthur Levitt. I mean, they're good people and they're good administrators. You know, well, they're not so good, but. This is a guy who, think of it, sat down with Tom Corcoran and Jim Rowe in an area where there had been no concept except that something had to be done. You had the Morgan hearings, you had the, you know, the midget in the lap, you had the Pecoris hearings, and wrote the 33 Act. In what period of time? Roosevelt was sworn in on March 4th of 1933. When was it enacted? September?
Yeah, something like that. The question. When you're working with him on...
Can you imagine if somebody said to you, regulate the securities industry?
He was 33 years old or 34 years old when he did it?
1899.
34 years old when he did it?
He was born in 1903, wasn't he?
I thought it was 1899.
No, I think he was born in 1903.
So was in his early 30s?
I mean, you sit down, and yeah, sure, he talked to Ben Cohen, and he talked to Tommy Corcoran, and he talked to Jim Rowe. He also had to deal with John Foster Dulles and Arthur Dean, who were representing the industry. And I don't know if you've read any of the hearings and the testimony of the hearings, but he was dealing with giants who... And then a year later, the 34 Act, and a year later, the Public Utility Holding Act, Holding Company Act, and a couple years later, the Trust and Venture Act, and then the 40 Act. Well, I mean, it's an unfair question.
He never really practiced before the commission after he left, did he?
Not that I'm aware of. Oh, well... He had a couple of, except in the Skyatron, he had this notion of pay TV, and he latched onto that client, or the client latched onto him. Skyatron was pay-as-you-go TV, in the 60s. It was ridiculous. You were going to interactive TV. How are you going to pay for TV? How are you going to pay for movies? You're going to have paid movies or TV? He was devoted to that. And nobody would take it seriously. Nobody would take it the securities, you know, the disclosures. What, you know, that was his baby for a while. Another baby. I mean, he had another baby that he practiced with before the commission. He represented the Association of Mutual Fund Sponsors, the sponsors of the contractual plans. They had gotten into trouble at one point in time on the question of whether they had to, you know, update their registration every year. They were selling mutual funds on the installment plan. Mm-hmm. And the question was, disclosure of changes and so forth. So he represented the Wellington funds and that, and later the Putnam funds. He represented Armand Hammer at one point, and a problem that he had with the commission involving the oil company. Not really. He was interested in the big things. Harry Bridges, and deportation of Harry Bridges.
Did he ever talk, I mean, given that you could argue that he invented securities regulation, 1960, here he is 30 years later, coming back to take a look after 26 years at his invention. Did he ever talk about how it had evolved in a way that he hadn't anticipated or had foreseen?
He did an article at that time. He did either a law review piece or a piece for the... it was one of the anniversaries, the 25th anniversary.
Which would have been 59.
Yeah. Yes, I think he did something for the 25th anniversary. On that.
Did he ever talk in terms of the report, whether his idea of the report was to try and bring these agencies back to his notion of how they were functioning in the 30s, or whether it was time to sort of change things?
Oh, no, it was time to change things. No, he was not living in the past. No, he was well aware of what was going on in all these agencies, what changes were required. I mean, just look at the proposals for the SEC and the fact that you needed to delegate, you had to separate the functions, and you had to,
One of the themes of the report is that when the agencies were created was that they would be staffed by very able people. And what seems to come through from the report is the idea that as the agencies aged, less and less able people came on, and the agencies became more politicized, so the appointments were from outside of the areas of expertise. Do you recall discussions about that topic?
Yes, and he would be even more aggravated now. When he got out of law school, even when I got out of law school 15 years after, 17 years after, the top members of the class, from the top schools, went into government service. That's, first of all, what was available to do. He had some security, he had some stature, and the so-called big law firms weren't that big, and there was no room. And the disparities in salary were not that great, so he started the commission at $1,800, he might have gotten $2,200 or $2,100 at the law firm. But as time went on, and even in his time, in the 60s, certainly now, I worry about where the good public servants are going to come from. And let's face it, we're not going to totally deregulate. I don't care what, the impetus is. And when the differentiation is such that, what do you start a lawyer out of school at? A GS-11?
That's right.
What is it? A 13 now.
How much?
A GS-13.
GS-13, which is how much? 40?
Mid-70s.
Is that much?
The SEC now can pay higher than standard government salaries.
Oh. But it's a little pipsqueak law firm. We start at 140.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a lot of difference. And that's an issue, I think, now than it was then, too. I don't think he felt that the... I don't think he felt that the when you had the Manny Cohens and the Woodsides and the Norths and those guys there, that they weren't up to it. No, I think there were people there who weren't up to it, but he had a lot of respect for Loomis. He had a lot of respect for Manny. He had the whole Mercantile Exchange, which is they worked with Loomis on and with Eisenberg and Levinson. You had great guys there in the 60s. I'm not saying you don't now. I don't know the staff now, except for you guys. You had your fools. I have great respect for that, institution.
And another question. In the report, there's discussion about the commissioners actually writing their own opinions. And that seemed to be something of great importance to you all when you were writing the report.
Right.
Why was that, and what was the thinking?
I think that he was thinking of the court and the philosophy that would be reflected in that. He felt that not only were they not writing their own opinions, they were not reading their own opinions. And he had some very strong people there later. I mean, like Art Fleischer, who was Manny Cohen's assistant. With all due respect to Manny, Art was a very strong guy.
We've taken up tremendous amount
of
time.
No, I'm
just. There's one thing I want to ask you on the tape recorder, because you had mentioned it before. And I just want to ask you again. You had talked about Landis's memos to John Kennedy in the 50s when he was in the hospital.
Right. Which became, although he never claimed credit for it, that's by inference, talking to his secretary and others, that he furnished a lot of the material which became Profiles in Courage. And I think the book acknowledges that in the acknowledgments of the foreword. You never saw Bobby Kennedy cry too often, but he cried at Jim's funeral. He was played a very important part in their lives. Let me show you a piece of correspondence I dug up.
We just want to thank you for taking so much time.
I'm delighted.
We've enjoyed this tremendously.
Thank you. I hope you did. you know, everybody says to me, I ought to write a memoir. It's an egotistical thing to do, but if two bright young guys want to sit around and listen to me, I'm delighted. Where are we? Have we covered whatever your...
That's it.
And we've covered far more than we ever would have hoped for.
This is terrific, and the Historical Society, I think, will be thrilled with this contribution. So,
excuse me, I'm sorry.
The Historical Society will be thrilled with this contribution. So we very much appreciate it.
Well, they edit out half of it, but I think better of it. But I doubt it.
Thank you very much.